Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the Lucky Let Cord podcast, a Tennis Now production sponsored by Tennis Express and a proud member of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm your host, Chris Otto. Happy to be with you as we wrap up the Sunshine Double. It is now April 4th. Clay season underway. The road to Roland Garros. We are on it now. We've got five different events taking place across the globe on the green and red clay. Mostly red, but a little bit of green in Charleston. But before we look forward to the clay too much, and we will look forward to the clay a little bit during this podcast, I want to talk with Tennis Now editor Richard Pagliaro about the Sunshine Double. Who were the big winners? What are the takeaways? So we're going to get into a discussion on what we saw over the last month across Indian Wells and Miami. Of course, great performances by Carlos Alcaraz and Iga Swiatek, who took the titles at Indian Wells. And of course, just over the weekend, we saw an amazing effort by Danielle Collins, soon to be retired Danielle Collins, wins her biggest title to date, and also a dominant performance from Jannik Sinner. There's lots of ins and outs and in-betweens, lots of players to talk about, so why don't we just get right to it? Richard Pagliaro is here. He's having difficulty with his Mets, who are now 0-5, so we figured we'd take his mind off the baseball and get into some tennis. Let's get into the interview. See you guys on the other side. Richard, we're back, man. Sunshine Double in the books. What's happening?
It's great. I mean, coming off a great Miami and right into clay season with Charleston and Monte Carlo around the corner. So, man, the train just picks up steam.
Yeah, it's that time of year. But today we're going to look back a little bit on a pretty special month in the States. The Sunshine Double was different than it has been in years past. I mean, it's always been for the last 15 years, right, dominated by the big names. And that's gradually starting to change. Alcaraz and Sinner, center stage for the men. And then the women, we had some Iga dominating at Indian Wells. Looks like it's a place she might dominate for many years to come. And then Danielle Collins, of course, with a huge surprise. Where do you want to start, Richard? I'll leave it to you.
I'd like to start with Danielle Collins just because, you know, to have a farewell tournament like that and go out the way she did, not just winning it, but really dominating some really, really strong players, and also the way she finished. I mean, that last game, if she gets broken in that last game, Rybakina was starting to pick it up. I mean, I know she was tired because Rybakina played a lot of long three-setters, but, I mean, she showed so much courage, I felt, in that last game. I really felt like she knew I have to close it right here because I don't want to give her a chance to serve and tie it. Who knows what's going to happen? And then she did it. I mean, so, yeah, I thought, phenomenal story, and just a storybook ending for someone who's from Florida who grew up on the public courts there, and to do it at home, it was just great. And also to see Serena, you know, to see Blake, to see all the celebrities, Tyson, Bonjo, you know, all these people turn out for her. You see how appreciated she is, in, you know, among Americans.
Yeah, Miami does good with the celebs, don't they?
They really do. They really do. They know how to treat them, and they, you know, they have the luxury boxes there, so it's great. The food is great. The drinks don't stop flowing. It's just a great time.
Yep, Jimmy Buckets is always there. Guy never leaves.
He's always there. Him and Zverev are tight. I saw that again. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what do you think about Collins, just in general, in terms of like the fact that she announces her retirement and then she does this? Do you think like a weight is lifted off of her shoulders, maybe, in a sense that, you know, all the physical issues, the rheumatoid arthritis, endometriosis, things that have been dragging her down physically, maybe she sees tennis and life a little bit differently now that there's a finish line at the end of all of this?
I think she definitely has perspective because of what you said, all she's been through physically and mentally. And also, she's just the type of person that I think she's played with a chip on her shoulder most of her life because she's always felt like people didn't respect me. They doubted me. They thought I was just some public park trashy kid. You know, like she just felt dissed. Mm-hmm. And I love that she's used that her whole life, basically, as fuel, used it in a really, really positive way. But you could hear the gratitude in her speech. She gave a really great speech. You could hear how grateful she was, especially to the fans. So, you know, that was great. I actually look at it the opposite way. I was reflecting on what Murray said at the U.S. Open a couple of years ago, where he said, even if I knew, like, this was going to be my last tournament, I would never say it publicly because I would feel the pressure would be so much more immense because every match people would be like, oh, he's going to retire. He's got to win this. He felt like he would just be piling up the pressure even more. So I felt for her, and I mean, she's just a straight up person. I mean, I respect her saying it, but I felt like, wow, it could really boomerang. It could really just make it even worse for her because you know how much she loves that tournament. You know, her big breakthroughs when she beat Venus at the old Miami Open on Crandon Park. You know how badly she wants to do well. I thought it could be a negative, but it was a positive in the end. And that's a credit to her, the way that she kind of looks at it. And also, just a quick thing, Lindsay Davenport told a great story on Tennis Channel where her son is friends with one of the top juniors. And the morning of the final, when Danielle went out to hit with this kid, a top junior, it was just her, like her with her bag and her towel. You know, no entourage, no coach, no people. I mean, here you are, you know, the biggest match of your life, you know, with the exception of the AO final that she lost.
Yeah.
And you just walk out there by yourself. Like,
yeah.
I'm ready to take it on. It's just me. It's on me. I mean, it's almost like how Tyson would just walk out with just the towel and no robe or, you know, just like, this is it. It's on me. I got to do it. And she did it.
Yep. Pretty clutch for her to save 10 of 11 break points in the final against Rybakina, who's, you know,
and
just her second top five
game,
win.
The four break point, I mean, she could have easily got broken that last game. She hit some huge shots in that last game.
Yeah, a lot of courageous tennis, right? I mean, just going for the lines and hitting them. Remarkable performance.
Yeah, I know she rubs a lot of people the wrong way. I hear it a lot when I talk to people who play tennis. They're like, oh, she's such a pain. I look at it the opposite. Like, she puts it out there, and it's about as raw and as real as it gets, you know? And she knows there's microphones on the court. She knows when she drops F-bombs, everyone's going to hear it and judge it. But she doesn't care because she's there to win.
Yeah.
That's what it's about, you know? And you got to respect that.
Yeah. You looking forward to six more months, maybe? You think she'll hang it up after, well, who knows, right? Maybe she'll even get into the WTA finals, but I'm thinking maybe after the U.S. Open she'll call it. But, you know, a lot of time for her to make more progress in the months that are coming up. I mean, she's playing great. She's got all the momentum, all the confidence. Maybe she can make another run at a slam.
It's funny, too, if you look at the early part of the season, she was coming up against Osaka, but I mean, really top. She had really tough draws, and she was playing these players going deep into the matches. So that's a credit to her that she took those losses as, hey, I'm in here. I'm right here till the end, three sets. And that she was able to carry that in a positive way back into my... I don't know what the future holds for her because hard court is by far her best surface, although she has had some results on clay as well. So you just want to see her fully healthy and fit for the North American hard court season because she'll definitely be feeling the love from, you know, American fans for sure. And you want to see her make another run. And look, she showed you what she can do in Australia. She showed you what she can do in Miami, the U.S. Open. It's just a perfect venue for her for that kind of ferocity. People eat that up.
Yeah, for sure. Looking forward to seeing what she can bring down the road. What about Grigor Dimitrov? I'm going to spin it around. I don't really have a plan today, but just things that really stuck out to me over this last month. One of them definitely is Grigor. Despite his loss to Jannik Sinner, we'll get to him in the final. Man, is he playing some great tennis, right?
Oh, man, Grigor, and we've talked about him on your show in the past because we both love watching him. And to me, even when he wasn't a top 10 player, he was a top 10 favorite player to watch because plays from everywhere on the court. He's one of the best volleyers, great overhead, beautiful mover, one of the better or best running forehands out there. And he can do it from anywhere. So it was so, and like Carlos said after that, after the Alcaraz match where he said he made me feel like a 13-year-old kid, I mean, he totally schooled him. You don't see a player that caliber, you very rarely, I should say, would you see a player of that caliber get schooled that bad. I mean, he just destroyed him. He made it look like he was on another level of play. I mean, I was there when he won the ATP Finals in London in 2017. That was the best I ever saw him play back-to-back-to-back, where he just played five fantastic matches. But those matches, the Alcaraz, I mean, that's one of the best matches I've ever seen him play. It was phenomenal tennis.
It was. It was just like flawless from start to finish. Amazing. I don't really know what Carlitos could have done. It seemed like he was playing okay. I mean, obviously you'd like to see him be able to protect his serve, maybe hammer down on the Dimitrov backhand. If there is a weakness, it's maybe on the return, but it wasn't. He had some great returns in that match.
Yeah, that's the thing, because he, even when he was really going great, Grigor, he'd play a lot of 7-5, 7-6 sets because guys serve big to the backhand, and he needed, but he's really sharpened the chip and the short chip, which Federer was so great at that, just taking the pace off and giving you the dead ball, like short angle ball where you have to come race up and then try to do something with it. He returned really well, and he hit a few backhand down the lines in that match against Alcaraz where you could see on Alcaraz's face it just blew his mind. Like, he just did not expect it. A couple times he looked over Ferrero and he just had this expression. It was almost like he wanted to laugh. Like, he just couldn't believe it, like the shots that Dimitrov was hitting. And that's huge respect, because our Alcaraz has played the best of the best. So yeah, he was on fire. I mean, that's just beautiful tennis. And it's the kind of tennis that, like, I really love to see, where he's attacking, he's coming in, he's using the slice, he's using all the shots, he's using all the angles, his overhead, and he just still, for his age, 32 years old, he hits the ball on the move so beautifully. It's really hard to do. Some of those forehands he hit were fantastic. So then when you saw all that, you're like, wow. And especially after the Zverev, because nobody was, even after that, Matt, people were like, oh, Zverev owns him, Zverev's going to school, you know. And then after that, you're thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe he can maybe at least test Sinner, and Sinner was having no part of that. It was just all.
Yeah.
I mean, Sinner just took, he did to Grigor what Grigor did to Alcaraz, basically.
Yeah, that was wild. I mean, sticking with Dimitrov, though, I mean, I think he's winning 80% of his first serve points, which is higher than his career average by a lot. 55% of his second serve points this year, which is also higher. He's 51% for his career, and he's making 66% of his first serves versus 62%. All these little things adding up to great results. But I will say, on that match with Alcaraz, Carlitos only able to win, I got the stats pulled up here. It's not like I have this crazy Steve Flink type memory for these type of things, but 19 of 34 first serve points, 56% for Carlos in that match, and 13-25 second serve. Broken four times in nine service games. So I think if you had to look at Alcaraz at anything that he should have been better at, it's holding serve on a fast court like Miami, and that maybe is a thing he'll want to look at in the future. But as far as Grigor goes, just amazing to see him back in the top 10. Flying the flag for the one-hander, always one of the best quotes in the sport, one of the great personalities, and still only 32 and a remarkably good mover for that age, and such an explosive mover, such a cadence and rhythm to his game. It really is beautiful to watch. I hope we see more of it this season.
Yeah, he's so great. Even when you put him in the corners, one of the great things I love about watching him is when you watch him take those lateral, those kind of stutter steps to recover back. Even the way he does that, it's so beautiful. It's almost like he's dancing on the court. I mean, it's really cool to see his foot. If you just watch for a game one time, just his feet, you know, from the knees down, the way his feet move. I mean, he's always moving, and he's always trying to move into the court and step into the court. And I think you're spot on the serve. I think a lot of it is the toss. He kind of seemed to have remedied. The toss used to get away from him. And also, to me, when I watch him now on the serve, he just looks like he either has a clarity or a comfort where it's not like he's standing there thinking, bouncing the ball. He gets the ball, and he's ready, and he has a plan. And I feel like when you don't overthink it, you know, it diminishes the double faults.
Yeah.
He played beautifully. I mean, he really, he's a wonder to watch when he's like that. And like you said, everyone was, oh, the one-hander. I mean, this guy, the one-hander is one of the most beautiful one-handers. So I hope he's in the top 10. And the other cool thing about him is he can do it on any surface, and he has done it on any surface as far as going deep. You know, look at Wimbledon. He was in the semis. I mean, he came close to a Wimbledon final that 2014, that year. He played a good match in that loss.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, he's definitely turning back the clock to 2017 right now, with back-to-back top five wins for the first time since 7 years ago, and then three consecutive top 10 wins at Miami. So, I mean, Hats off to Grigor, now 20-5 on the season. But you look at the differences between Sinner and Alcaraz on fast surfaces, maybe, and that's what you can point to, is the way that Yannick protected his first serve in that final, winning 21 of 24 first serve points and 12 of 19 second serve points. Faced only one break point, so kind of took the wind out of Grigor's sails there, and then, of course, was able to break him four times, just completely dominant. And let's talk about Yannick Sinner right now. Number two in the world for the first time ever, second Masters. He's breaking all these records for Italian men. He's the only Italian man to win multiple Masters 1000 titles. He's got more ATP titles than any other Italian man. He's the highest Italian ranking-wise ever, and it looks like he really does have a legit shot at number one, given how few points he has to protect on the clay, although it's not his best surface. We all know that. 14 of his 15 top five wins have come on hard, just one on clay thus far. But you got to think that Yannick's going to have a better season than ever on the clay, given all the confidence he's going to carry over to Europe.
Yeah, I mean, really, he's almost undefeated on the year, despite the Alcaraz loss, because it sounded like he was ill for that, that he just was felt weak in that. I mean, it's almost an undefeated run. And, yeah, the big challenge is clay, because he hasn't done it, especially in Paris. You know, he had the quarterfinal early on, and then since then he hasn't really, really gone deep, although he's had some nice matches in Rome in front of the home fence. But I think that'll work to his favor in that, it, not that he's a content kind of guy anyway, he's a hungry guy, but I think it'll motivate him even more, that it'll be like, look, I got to prove that I can do it on clay. Secondly, with Rafa now totally up in the air physically, where you don't know what he's going to be or where he's going to be or if he's even going to be there, and also with Novak looking much more vulnerable, that's got to plant a seed in his head. I mean, this guy could be halfway to a Grand Slam. If he played like he did in Miami and Paris, that would be unbelievable. I mean, but it's not inconceivable, the level he's playing. Look at what Dimitrov said after the match. He said this guy is the best player in the way he's playing right now, he is the best player. You can't argue that. He is. Yeah. It's just whether he can do it, whether he can translate it to the clay. But for me, he'll be more successful than someone like Medvedev, just because simply the core positioning, that he's much more comfortable straddling the baseline, he's much better taking it on the rise, and he's in his DNA, in his head, he wants to dictate. So that's all to his favor. You know, he just got to do it now.
Yeah, no reason he can't do better than ever on the clay, and we'll see. Novak, let's talk about Novak. Well, first, with Sinner, tell me which is maybe the one quality which has impressed you the most from him this season as he goes 22-1, wins his first major, and now the Miami title.
I always believed in his game, but I would say the dominance and the ability to disarm some of these guys. Like, you don't see Medvedev schooled like that on a hard court, where it's like he's struggling to win game, where he's struggling to, like, hold serves on a hard court. That doesn't happen to Medvedev. That just doesn't happen if you think about it. So
yeah,
that's been the biggest surprise, not just that he's win, but he just steamrolled these guys. And, like, we just spent 10 minutes talking about how great we were all impressed by Dimitrov, and you know, deservedly so. He played phenomenal. I mean, he just made him look ordinary in that final. Like, it was almost like, whoa, this match is over. Like, he's not going to lose. I mean, it was that convincing. So,
I mean,
now these guys got to step up and they got to counter him. But the other thing is, physically, he's impressed me. That was always a thing, you know, because he always looked kind of like a little bit scrawny because he's tall. He's a little bit. You can see the leg, the development of his leg. He's physically stronger, you know, and he's not afraid to play the longer rallies, so all that. And he's just better in every department. His game is better in every single phase.
Yeah, and the experience is paying off. And you talk about the Medvedev match, 6-1, 6-2. Daniil Medvedev was able to win 24 of 50 points behind his serve. That's not the second serve. That's the whole serving. Broken four times. He just didn't have a chance.
Yeah. He overwhelmed him. It was impressive, yeah. Yeah, it was really, really impressive. And the thing with him is he has that confidence such that it's just the shots just flow from him, like all the right answers. Whereas you see Carlos, you know, had a great, great Indian Wells. But even Carlos, sometimes he'll be over the box, he looks a little bit confused. Like, you made the point in the Dimitrov match, you know, to lose that many first serve points, like, dude, you got to hit some right into the body at that point. And because Dimitrov, he's crowding the line, he's got a long swing off the back, you got to jam it right into his hip at that point. But he's not, he doesn't have that. He's 20 years old. I mean, he's still learning what he should do. But to me, Sinner just looks more, as far as the mental side of it, he knows exactly what he wants to do. He just wants to dismantle you, and he's doing one hell For sure.
Yeah. So we segue into Novak. I mean, the loss to Luke Gennardi at Indian Wells, surprising, of course, but you know, these things happen with Novak. He's really geared up for the slams more and more than ever. And now it's crazy because after that happens, we find him parting ways with longtime coach Goran Ivanišević. And then you have to wonder, what is the motivation for this move with Novak? Is he looking for something new for this one last push in his career? I mean, we can only speculate based on what's out there. And what has your speculation led you to, Richard? Why do you think Novak made this move, and what do you think is going to happen in the weeks and months to come?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, initially I thought maybe it was a travel thing, but, you know, since he's not playing as many tournaments and since Goran is there at the big tournaments, I can't see travel being an obstacle. I know Goran he's married, stuff like that, but that doesn't seem to be an issue. I was surprised, to be honest, because my impression for the video I saw wasn't there, but you were out there in Indian Wells before that at UCLA. He was there. From what I saw, Goran was there at UCLA, and that was in March. Yeah. So it took me by surprise. I really don't know. I can't. I'd like to hear him. I'm sure he'll talk about it in Monte Carlo. I really don't. I'd just be speculating. I don't know. Right. I mean, I really respect Goran. I think they had a great partnership. And when I watched them practice, you know, give Goran would challenge him, man. Goran wasn't afraid to get in his face. I mean, they would have sometimes go back and forth, not arguments, but Goran would stand his. I mean, Goran knows what he's doing. So I don't know. I have no idea why they split. I was sorry to see it happen. From what I've read and been told, that is Zimonjić might be the guy, just because he's, you know, they've known each other so long, and he maybe wants someone local where it's more, there's more of a comfort level. But I don't know. I have no idea. Yeah. Who, or, you know, maybe he'll go coachless for a while. But you would think for the slams he would want someone there, at least for the slams, you would think.
Yeah, I mean, Zimonjić makes sense. You know, he's got the Davis Cup captaincy under his belt. He's had a lot of experience, great doubles player.
And they've played side by side in big Davis Cup. I mean, they've been through the battles together. They know each other. They really love and respect each other.
Yeah, I mean, that could work. I mean, if I do speculate, I would just assume that Djokovic felt a little bit flat at this part of the season, having not won Australia for the first time in eons, and maybe heading into April without a title for just, like, I think it's the third time since 2006. And he just wanted a little bit of a spark, maybe felt he needed a spark, felt he needed a change. Maybe they both felt it together. And so here we are wondering who's going to coach Novak for the clay season, because I do like him on the clay. You know, he's got 3 RG titles now, and you have to think he's the guy with the experience. But, I mean, the winds of change are blowing harder than ever at this point in tennis history, right? So you're thinking Carlos and Jannik are coming on. Casper Ruud is going to be a tough out on the clay. It's not going to be an easy one for Novak to win, but it also does present a great opportunity for him without Nadal no longer in the mix for him to kind of continue to dominate on the clay. So it's going to be a fascinating clay season. You look to Monte Carlo next week. It's not always the place we can gauge on who's in what type of form for the rest of the season, but it's going to be really interesting to see how things start to play out. I mean, there's a lot of good clay quarters out there, and it could look a lot different than what we've seen over the last month.
Yeah, and I think you hit on 2 good things. Not that he needs added motivation. He's Novak Djokovic. We all know what a warrior he is, but look, he's human, you know, and if you see Rafa is ailing or potentially not there, you know, that's a big thing. I mean, that's a big thing in terms of just more inspiration, motivation. And the other thing, yeah, I mean, you're right about Australia. He definitely looked flat to me. I don't know if bringing in another coach is going to, you know, suddenly charge it. But to me, that's really where it comes down to. But I still would side with him just because I know he's 36. I know he's getting older. But you look at him in 5 sets, I mean, he has a phenomenal five-set record. I mean, it's hard to go against him in five sets, but then you come up against guys where you're giving up 10, 12, 13 years, and they're younger, stronger, and in some cases faster. That's where it all, sort of the rubber hits the road, where we're going to find out where he's at. But I definitely do not doubt him at all. I think he's going to come back sort of turbocharged.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that it might be his last chance to pick up more slams these next two or three this year?
No, because Australia, I still think he's in the mix for Australia. No, I'd say the next year, but I don't think it's like, oh, if he doesn't do it this year, he's not going to get to 20. Because I still, for Australia, I mean, look at his record there.
Yeah,
you still have to look at him there.
You do. Of course,
he's got the best grass court. It's weird. I mean, even though Alcaraz beat him, Alcaraz is such a novice on grass. But then again, Alcaraz won back-to-back grass titles. So the grass will be really, really interesting because to me, Sinner would be a bigger, just the way his game is right now, he'd be a bigger threat at Wimbledon than Roland Garros for me.
But seems like, you know, it, right?
I'm not saying he can't win Roland Garros, but I just think his game is better right now for grass just because he can hit you right off the court.
Yeah, I know. It makes sense. It's going to be
interesting.
You can't
defend him. If he's hitting like that on grass, you're not going to be able. You can't defend. You can't come out of the quarters on grass. You just can't do it.
Yeah, it's going to be a fascinating time because honestly, I don't know what to make of Novak right now. And
yeah, and you won't know till you see him. So it's. Yeah. I mean, I think he's going to. He look. You know, you think he is, but you know, still. And these guys will be studying it. So it's almost like the microscope is turned up even more. But look, he knows. I mean, he's right on the precipice. He's so close. And also the Olympics. That's a huge, huge thing for him. He doesn't have a gold medal. He wants that really, really badly. So I think he's all in for this period, the Roland Garros, the Olympics, and Wimbledon.
Yeah, and if that's the case, then it makes it interesting for the U.S. Open. There's going to be a lot of guys dragging after that kind of a push coming to Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah. You're going to see injuries. You're going to see lower body. You're going to see people get banged up. It's going to be a lot of tennis and a lot of pressure. And, I hate to say it, but you're going to see people get hurt.
Very compressed. It's going to be wild. I think, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm excited to find out what Novak has left. He's still 36, not 37 on May 22nd. So at Roland Garros. So, you know, I think Rafa's the cautionary tale. Like it could all change on a dime. And with Rafa pulling out of Monte Carlo now, you expected that, of course, but the tone of his messaging sounds very scary.
Very ominous because prior to the Vegas thing, he had sounded encouraged, you know, that he's doing the right things, things are progressing, so, but slowly but surely, stuff like that, and it was a different message. So, I'm concerned. I'm concerned. And you're right, it could change instant. We saw with Roger, too, and you could even say to some extent Serena. I mean, she never got it back.
Yeah, Roger came back, and there was a moment where you thought anything was possible, and then you quickly realized that it just wasn't anymore, and that was pretty crazy.
The Hubert Hurkacz match at Wimbledon, that's where you're like, wow, man, reality has hit.
Yeah, I know. Don't look forward to seeing that with Novak, but it'll probably have to come at some point.
Yeah, but I don't think he's there right now. I don't think that's him, and I think he had a bad match. I mean, Sinner rolled. I mean, Sinner beat him straight up. I mean, I wouldn't despair. I mean, I think he's going to come back. He knows it's now. This is it. This is the time. You know, I think he's ready to. Maybe you're 100% right. Maybe it's just like, look, I need a new voice, someone to fire me through the finish line here, and he's certainly capable of doing it.
Yeah, for sure. 25 would be a crazy number, right? That's one.
Yeah, he wants that
25 Olympic gold, a lot on the table. Still number one in the world. Still number one in the world. And could, you know, who knows how many? What is it? 423 now. I don't even know what the ridiculous count of weeks at number one. No, I mean, just remarkable. So anyway,
the only thing that doesn't plays in my head is Sinner's on one of these historic rolls. I mean, when you get this kind of roll going, I mean, look at his record against the top 10 since last November. I mean, he's almost unbeatable against the best. When you get that kind of confidence, if he can carry it out of the clay, I mean, who knows what this guy's going to do.
Yeah, I know. It does have shades of Djokovic, right? It's 2011, was it? After he won the Davis Cup, mind you.
Remarkable. And that gives you a whole boost. Now imagine the homecoming he's going to get in Rome after he delivers the Davis Cup, after the performance he had there. I mean, it's every match is going to be like a circus. It's going to be great, like a rock show.
Yeah, pretty good stuff. Maybe some low-key hits on around the tour for the last month. Iga looked good at Indian Wells. I think her chances on clay are just still, she's the prohibitive favorite. Have to like her on this surface. Don't think anything that happened in Miami will take her out of sync once she gets on the red stuff.
No, I think the surface will help her. I think in Miami, Alexandrova, she was wisely used the surface to her advantage and rushed Iga. I was a little surprised to see that mentally she got frustrated pretty quickly. Like, you had to expect she's going to go hard to your forehand. Like, why is that a surprise? I mean, hey, look, she's human. We all get frustrated. I just felt like she got frustrated a little quickly there. But yeah. Clay is a whole different animal. It's a whole different surface. She's going to have the time to run around and set up for the forehand. And when she's hitting the forehand with confidence, you know, the question people still have is about the serve, but look, she's won some pretty big titles with that serve, so
yeah,
let's see how it goes.
I mean, that it's obvious why she's working on that serve and why she wants it to be better, so she can control more of the points against players like Alexandrova, Rybakina, all the type of players that trouble her. And even if it doesn't work on the hard courts, which it didn't, and maybe that's why her frustration is coming, because it's taking a little longer than she thought, or maybe she on the clay, she's going to be able to dictate more of the points with her serve and with everything else in her game. So, you know, I mean, but anything can happen. You have to think that Sabalenka is still in the mix and Rybakina looks pretty damn good on clay, having won the Rome title. I think she was on an 8-match winning streak until she got sick at Roland Garros.
Right.
Too many illnesses for Rybakina. Let's hope she has a healthy spring, and it'll be fascinating to see how it turns out. Let me ask you a quick off the cuff, offbeat question. Which of these four players is going to have a better ranking at the end of the season? Will it be world number 332, Angelique Kerber? World number 126, Caroline Wozniacki? World number 192, Naomi Osaka? Or world number 264, Amanda Anisimova?
I would say Osaka, although Anisimova has shown me a lot in that Pegula match. I mean, I just worry about her because she looked like her back was bothering her in that match. She just seems to get a little banged up here and there, but I believe in Anisimova's game, but I would say Osaka of those players. I like what I've seen about Wozniacki, but she has the calf taped up again. That's been a chronic issue, and to me, the forehand, she just can't finish with the forehand. That's a problem when you're facing these people like Rybakina, Sabalenka, and people go, oh, well, Coco with her forehand, but Coco's one of the fastest players on the tour. You know, it's a different, and Coco can pop the serve 120 miles an hour. It's a different sort of thing. So I haven't seen that she can finish with the forehand. And I don't think you can play a neutral or defensive game and win slams against those players. Although to her credit, she's had some pretty good wins. You got to give it to her. And Kerber, I don't know. I just don't think the serve is there. I just don't think the second serve. I think they're going to eat up the second serve. I really do.
Some big wins at Indian Wells for Angelique, which was
for
nice.
Sure. And you can never discount. I mean, she's been number one in the world, and she obviously believes it, or she wouldn't be out there. So I'm not being dismissive. I'm not saying she can't have good wins, good results. But if we're talking about competing for slams, no, I mean, I don't see that happening. I think Osaka will be there, you know, eventually. It's going to take time. But Anisimova's shown me a lot, even the matches she's lost. I mean, she hits the ball great. It's just she can't string tournaments together because she's always getting hurt. So that's a problem. But if she could put together just one healthy year, I mean, she's a top 10, top 15 talent, no question.
Only 22 years of age, whereas Kerber.
And look what she did
at
Roland Garros. She got to the. I mean, she can do it on any surface. She's had wins on every surface, big wins.
Yeah. Well, since I have the pleasure of speaking with you today, I'm going to give you another quick question. Five Americans in the.
I hope it doesn't involve any math. Because
five Americans in the top 30 right now. Which one is going to be the highest rank in the end of the season? We got Fritz at 13, Paul at 15, Ben Shelton at 16, Francis Tiafoe 7-7 on the season down to 21, and Sebastian Korda at 27. Which of those five do you think is going to take home the number one American honors at the end of the season? And Do you think any of them will hit the top 10?
I think a couple of them could pierce the top 10, or will they finish the year in the top 10? I don't. That's a tougher ask. I would say either Shelton or Fritz is going to be the top American.
Okay.
One of those two guys. Not that I mean, I like the other. And Tommy Paul always, I love watching him play. He's always there. I just think the other two guys have bigger weapons.
Yeah. Yep.
And Shelton, you know, I just think lately he's been getting dragged into longer rallies. But I don't know if you saw that match in Miami that he lost to Musetti. That was such a fun. That was a great match. The crowd was really into it. It was a smaller court, and
that's a good
even
match.
When he loses, he's a lot of fun to watch. But I think he has more desire, basically.
Yeah, Musetti's playing awesome in that match. That was definitely not a bad loss at all.
No, not at all. Musetti hit a couple running backhand passes that were just outrageous. Yeah, Musetti came up huge in that match.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I like Ben also. He doesn't have a lot of points to defend between now and the U.S. Open.
Yeah. He basically has nothing until now. But then the Open, that's a big thing. So you want to see him be there, already up there, in case something happens at the Open.
Yep.
But he has a personality, to me, that plays great at the U.S. Open. He loves it. And people get on him for the hang. I love seeing that. I have no problem. I hope he does other stuff, you know? I mean, he's just expressing himself. He's a kid. That's what kids do. Go to the park. Watch kids play. They do it all the time.
Yeah, let him have some fun,
big
right?
Big deal. You know, if you don't like it, you got to go beat him and shut him up, and that's what Novak did. But to me, it brings the edge out in the game, so I like that he does stuff like that. I hope he never changes.
I definitely like it. I definitely
and you see how he is with kids after the he does all. I mean, he's one of the big autograph selfie guy. He's really good with fans too.
Yep. And just the last word on Paul, I thought he was magnificent at Indian Wells. I watched him against Casper in the quarters, I think it was, up close. I just think he's playing so well and attacking the net so with such regularity. It's inspiring to see him play that type of tennis, and I think he was playing great against Medvedev. He just tweaked that ankle, and I just hope he can recover from that soon enough to do some more on the clay. I think there's a shot for him to get top 10.
Yeah, for sure. He's played great, and the attacking game, for him to bring it back. I saw his interview with Prakash on TC where he said his favorite player is Tim Henman. Like, you would never hear any players say that. Never.
Got a good volley.
Cool. And he's so much fun to watch, and he just brings it, you know. He's another guy that, like Dimitrov in a different way, that he can do it from anywhere on the court, and I love seeing that because of the unpredictability factor. You don't know what he's going to do. He'll serve in volley, too. He did that against Medvedev a little bit.
Yep. He's a real talent. Nice kid to talk
to. He really
to
is. And he gives it all every match. I mean, he really goes after it. So he's fun. And he, like you said, he can play to a high level on every surface, so that's great for American tennis. I just think, to me, Shelton with the lefty serve, you know, you've got the advantage on the outside every time. He's got the heat, the 140, but also when he gets that sharpened slice, it's just so hard to defend him. It's just he's got, you know, his baseline game, obviously a work in progress, but his instinct is to move forward, and I like seeing that from him. He doesn't back off.
Yep, absolutely. So I think we can cut it. Maybe we'll come back after Monte Carlo, get a little clearer picture of what the clay court season is looking like after this week's events. And then, of course, the first Master of the Year comes fast and furious. So let's do that. And by the way, Richard, bad news. Mets went down 6-3.
Right. Yeah, it's been a tough start, yeah.
0-5.
Yeah.
But we love them, right?
We sure do. Yeah, I've been trying to get you to a game there for years, and you've always ducked out. So I don't know.
This year.
Do you like Blinks the same way. It's always, oh, yeah, we're going to go next. It's always next
This
time.
Year we're going, man. I'm telling
you. This year.
I'm going to come early to the Open just for that. But the Orioles are 4-2, by the way.
They might be 0-150 by then. They might be like 20 and, you know, 120.
They're going to win the second game of this doubleheader tonight.
Yeah.
I promise you.
Eventually they got to win.
All right. Anything to add before we cut it?
I thought Miami was great. Also, the crowds that the fans came out, there were huge crowds for those night matches. I wasn't there this year, but the one thing I kept hearing was that the scoreboard, they didn't always play the replays. I wish they would do that because the replays, people love seeing some of those shots. But I talked to a lot of people who were there. They said the vibe was great, and the crowds were really, really great there. I mean, every match I saw, it was packed or near packed.
Oh, yeah, some of those South American battles, and Nico Jarry.
When you
South
had
American
Chile
fans.
Against Brazil, I mean, it looked like they were going to throw down. Nico Jarry, he's a big dude, too. I would not want to throw down with that. And he wears that nasal strip. He looks like a boxer or something, you know.
It was some good atmosphere there. I have to say it has really impressed and surprised me since it moved to the Hard Rock Stadium. I think they've done a good job making that venue as good as it can be.
I thought it was really never going to get that South American flavor that it had when Guga played and Marcelo Rios and all this, but they've really done a great job, and people bring in the flags and people dress up, and you really see the vibe. Also, they have some nice smaller courts that are almost like mini stadium, like the Butch Buckles. It's a really nice court, and it's right adjacent to the bar, so you can have a drink. So the smaller courts like Grandstand are really, really good. The only problem is all the outer courts are in the sun, and then you get in the stadium, it's totally almost enclosed. It's a whole different – it's almost like it's – the dramatic contrast from shade to everything else is really bright. So it's a little – for the players, that's an adjustment, but for the fans, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Cool, man. Thanks for chatting as always, Richard. Best of luck to the
Mets. Good talking to you, Chris. Thanks a lot.
All right, we'll talk soon. Ciao.
This edition of the Lucky Letcourt podcast is a wrap. Special thanks to Richard Pagliaro for joining and breaking down what was the Sunshine Double 2024. And we're looking ahead to the clay now. You guys know where to find us out on social media at Facebook, facebook.com/tennisnow, on Twitter at @tennis_now. And we'd love it if you rate, review, subscribe to this podcast. You can dial it up on Apple Podcasts. Just type in Lucky Letcourt podcast. Voila, you'll find us there. It means a lot that you're listening. And of course, it would mean a lot if you rate, review, subscribe. That would be huge. You can also find us wherever you find your podcasts. Spotify is my fave, or my second fave, besides Apple Podcasts. And anywhere else you find your podcasts, we'll be there. And of course, keep it tuned to www.tennisnow.com and on our YouTube page as well. We'll keep you updated on all the happenings for the clay court season from now until first ball at Roland Garros. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you guys soon.